is, and I hope I pronounce his name correctly, Erasmo Pena versus the state, case number 53470. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Bayless? Okay, and Mr. Figler, are you going to argue?
I'm going to start, Your Honor.
Okay, fine.
May it please the court, my name is David Figler, alongside with Mark Bayless. We represent Erasmo Pena, and we represent him at trial as well. And with the court's permission, Mr. Bayless is present and prepared to discuss the issue of the constitutionality of the disallowance of key testimony based on the alleged failure to notice. And I will be ceding part of my time to him, and then we will ask to reserve just a few more minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court previously dubbed the case before you as largely circumstantial and identified, quote, only one arguably reliable witness. While not specifically identified, it can be gleaned very easily from the opinion, and logic dictates that the one arguably reliable witness referred to by the court at the first trial was Monica Sotelo. It was, after all, Monica Sotelo and only Monica Sotelo who at the first trial suggested and only suggested that Erasmo Pena uttered the expression, "I'm going to smoke that fool," a short time before Gilbert Valenzuela was shot by someone. That would be a specific indication of intent, perhaps. And it was the prosecutor vouching for Monica Sotelo by making veiled references to her prison status that was one of the causes of the ultimate reversal. It was certainly pointed out that that would be improper as well as disparaging counsel. Indeed, when faced with such a weak case, the original prosecutor succumbed to the temptation to go beyond accepted practice, to vouch and engage in prosecutorial misconduct in his closing, and he got his conviction, but it was tainted, and this body reversed it. By the time of the retrial, this weak, circumstantial case against Erasmo Pena had deteriorated for the state. Their star witness, Monica Sotelo, had expressed her intent to recant her prior testimony. Regarding that statement, "I'm going to smoke that fool," arguably the best piece of evidence for the state, it should have never been admitted at the first trial. It was suspect. It could have been made in the manner suggested. It could not have been made in the manner suggested. And though somewhat lost in translation, the original testimony of Sotelo was that when she went outside, a group of men were talking, and one who, quote unquote, looked like Pena made the statement. At the second trial, however, Sotelo said she wasn't sure Pena was in that group, and she couldn't hear what they were saying, and that at worst it was merely mumbling. That said, she claimed the bulk of her testimony that she presented at the first trial was to please the decedent's family, some of whom were present in the courtroom, and was based upon their assumptions, the assumptions of Emma Garcia and the rest of Gilbert's clan. And that's all the state's case that remained, a weak, circumstantial case based on the assumption that if Erasmo Pena was the one who had a conflict with Gilbert and his clan inside the house, it must have been Erasmo who shot Gilbert on the outside.
Mr. Figler, isn't circumstantial evidence enough to convict if the jury believes?
Well, you know, Your Honor, but for the prosecutorial misconduct that I will discuss, but for the...
That wasn't the question. The question is, isn't that enough by itself to convict?
Generally, circumstantial evidence is allowed to support a conviction. Absolutely. But if it's a starting point for looking at the rest of the case, and of course, determining whether or not there is harmless error with regard to the various averments of error by the prosecutor, the fact that it is a circumstantial case, or a largely circumstantial case, would certainly come into play. And the fact that it is deteriorated from this court's prior proclamation that the case is largely circumstantial certainly would come into account when evaluating harmless error, when evaluating the Big Pond standard with regard to cumulative error.
And additionally, I know it was a prior case and a prior ruling by the court, but we do have to be careful as we look at the two cases, both jointly and severally, in this case. We can't just build it upon the difference in what was found in the first case versus the second, but there are points that are important that you're going to argue.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, on that score, if you could help me out, I'm having difficulty understanding the appellant's argument regarding the use of the transcript to refresh Sotelo's memory. How did the district court abuse its discretion and allow? I mean, you can, we sometimes joke, but you can show somebody a ham sandwich to refresh their memory. How is this any different? Before we get into the point about the statement and whether it could be considered and the like, how is that an abuse of discretion?
Well, you have to consider the circumstances, Your Honor, because the overarching principles of the admission of evidence are always going to be in play, whether something is much more prejudicial than any kind of probative importance that it might have. Now, here the state would be on notice that not only was the statement initially being disavowed, let's look at the evolution of the statement. I'm going to smoke that fool. It started out as being something that she thought she could attribute to Erasmo Pena. At the second trial, the defense did a very fine job in establishing that she couldn't have even been present in the backyard based on all of the witnesses' testimony that Monica Sotelo was somewhere else. Finally, she testified very clearly upon Mr. Bayless's examination that he did not make that statement. So what basically happens is the state is trying to therefore impeach her or refresh her recollection as to something that was stated previously that was suspect and probably shouldn't have been admitted in the first trial. So it really isn't as much an error on the part of the court allowing them to refresh her recollection so much as embedded in the entire discussion is the problematic nature of the state using highly suspect hearsay that should never have been admitted in that first trial to therefore get into that statement with the second jury. In other words, the only way that the state could present this highly suspect and highly prejudicial comment, I'm going to smoke that fool, to the jury, which they completely relied upon in their closing argument, again, was to do it through the guise of recollection, refreshing her recollection. She said that it didn't happen. She had no failure of actual recollection.
Counsel, didn't she indicate that, testify that she did not currently, 2009, recall Pena saying that, but she did testify to it in 2004, and she did not lie, nor did she have a reason to lie in 2004. Wasn't that part of her testimony?
It was part of her testimony, but the very unequivocal part of her testimony, when Mr. Bayless asked her, and I would cite to the appellant's appendix, volume 3, 598. I'm sorry, I went one too far. When he asked her about that, and I don't have, I'm sorry, I pulled the wrong part of that, but basically Mr. Bayless had asked her unequivocally, did you hear him say that? And she said no. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. It's at volume 3, appellant's appendix 573. And could you hear what they were saying? No. And you have no idea what they were saying. Yes, that's what she said. So, you know, the game of recollection of a suspect statement, she was completely disavowing it.
And she had previously said that she didn't recall when it was presented to her, but she did it indicate, like I said, if she said it and she was shown it, she didn't lie. So we're stuck with these two differing opinions, which we weren't triers of fact. Why shouldn't have not, as was indicated, why shouldn't have?
Well, and not to belabor the point, but I think that initially it was that someone who looked like Erasmo Pena, so if it was inadmissible, or it should have been inadmissible in the first trial, and then it was being used to refresh, it wasn't being offered as merely to refresh her recollection. It was being offered for the truth of the matter stated. That was the only purpose that the state used that for, was to present it to the jury in this new format saying, look, didn't you say before? And, you know, I think it would be very difficult for a recanting witness, someone who's already in prison, to not be aware of the penalties of perjury, et cetera. It becomes a very difficult situation, but unequivocally, she did indeed recant. The statement should never have been admitted in the first place, and its use in the second trial was absolutely
improper. Well, I'm just a little bit surprised at the method by which and I'll ask the prosecutor to comment about this. When you refresh someone's memory, you show them the document, ask them to read it, ask them if their memory's refreshed. If their answer is no, that's the end of the day.
And that should have been the process, and we did object, and I think to that extent, Your Honor, would be correct that that would be error by the district court to allow that to go forward in any other process or any other way. I think that if I could just step back from my statement before with regard to the error of the district court, when we objected to that, we knew exactly what was going on with regard to trying to get that statement back before the jury again, the suspect rogue statement that was being utterly recanted. And we knew that the method was going to be used to and exploited. So to that extent, we certainly did object, and we objected to the
statement. Mr. Figler, if there's some other point you want to make before your colleague argues, you better make it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And what I would like to do at this point then, Judge, is cede the rest of my time to Mr. Bayless.
Okay, thank you. Morning, Mr. Bayless.
Good morning, Justice Preston. Thank you for this opportunity to allow me to argue before the court.
To cut to the chase, isn't there a difference between the rule in Gray concerning experts and what's being advocated here?
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so why should we make this difference?
And there's a big picture issue that I'm presenting, and then there's the abuse of discretion issue by the district court and completing excluding. And based on the court's indication, I'm going to go to the big picture issue first. And that's whether NRS 174.234A1, 1A1, and 2 are unconstitutional. And obviously, the part of the statute that has given the district courts and this court, as evident from first with Benninger and later in Floyd, which abrogated in Gray, is the phrase, all witnesses of the defendant and intends to call during the case in chief. And as the court recognized in Gray, in most circumstances, any evidence presented by a criminal defendant could be properly characterized as evidence in rebuttal. So the issue then becomes, first of all, it's always been my position that a lay rebuttal witness does not have to be noticed under the statute. But as a practical matter, if the court determines that all witnesses by the defense must be noticed, including lay rebuttal witnesses, there is no reciprocal duty on the state to notice lay rebuttal witnesses. Now, I have done extensive research reviewing not only this court's published opinions, but unpublished dispositions. And from what I can tell, the court has not made a determination as to the state's duty to notice lay rebuttal witnesses. The court, I think...
Well, that's why we sent you and Ms. Piper an invitation to be here today.
I will. And the court, just so you know, the district court was aware of Gray also. And the district court's interpretation of Gray was that we would have to notice all witnesses, if there was, and this is the court's words, any eventuality or possibility that they were be called at trial. And I submit to the court that that interpretation renders the statute unconstitutional because it does not place any reciprocal duty on the state. And quite frankly, when I read the Gray decision, I applauded this court for its attempts to render the trials in the district court to allow the defense to receive a fair trial. But I think the court may be on a slippery slope in the Gray decision because essentially, and the court recognized that the concerns with expert rebuttal witnesses aren't there when it comes to lay rebuttal witnesses. And part of the reason is when you do a notice with your expert rebuttal witnesses, you have to give more than just the name and address. You have to give the subject matter, the CV, and the opposing party can tell whether they're going to call a rebuttal witness as to an expert rebuttal witness.
Let me run this observation by you and get your reaction. I've always thought the statute was curious because of the use of the term case in chief in the context of a defense case. I don't know that you really have a case in chief unless there is an affirmative defense that you have the burden for. Is that how we should apply that language?
I would advise the court that when I read the legislative history of this statute after the Benninger decision, when they were discussions about what case in chief meant. As both to the state and the defendant, it was the initial presentation by either party. It did not include rebuttal witnesses. And that's why I said the court may be on a slippery slope in the Gray decision, because you've carved out an exception to rebuttal witnesses. I will tell you, if they had wanted, and I'm only got 54 seconds, so I would like to reserve.
We've asked you some questions and Mr. Figler questions. We'll expand your time and that of Ms. Piper's.
If they had wanted to include rebuttal witnesses, rather than use the words case in chief, they could have used the word trial, all witnesses you intended to call at trial. By using the words case in chief, technically, as the court's aware, there's the state's case in chief, then the defense presents their case, and then the state's allowed rebuttal witnesses. And as written, with the use of the words case in chief, it requires the defense to include all their witnesses, even though, as a practical matter, the case in chief for defense is actually rebuttal evidence. There is no reciprocal duty on the state to reveal their rebuttal evidence. And again, the court has broached this issue in unpublished dispositions, which are obviously under Supreme Court Rule 123, we can't use as precedent. But the court recognized that if it's called in the state's rebuttal case, not in their case in chief, they're not required to give notice. That same opportunity is not given to the defense as the statute is written. While I applaud this court in its great decision, I think it's time to put the statute out of its misery. I think the words case in chief has caused nothing but problems in the district courts and in the interpretation of the statute. I think it needs to go back to the legislature. They looked at the Benninger decision, and like I said, if they had wanted to make all witnesses to be revealed, they should have used the word trial. And that would have been the remedy. They chose case in chief, and because of such, there is no reciprocal duty to the state for lay rebuttal witnesses, and obviously that violates United States and both in the United States and Nevada constitutions.
All right, Mr. Bayless, any questions by my colleagues? Thank you very much. I'll give the appellant 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Ms. Piper, good morning.
Good morning, Danielle Piper on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office for respondent. Would you like me to address the rebuttal issue and then go to impeachment?
You go wherever you'd like to go, but I think you know the issues that we're kind of interested in hearing you comment about.
Okay. What I'd like to do...
But I don't want to restrict you. I mean, you feel free to argue whatever else you'd like to talk about.
Okay. I'll talk about the rebuttal issue first. What I'd like to direct the court to is Volume 6, page 444 through 466. In that, and what I want to do is give some context to this rebuttal issue. The issue in regard to Mr. Silverstein testifying as a witness was this. The defense had some notes from Mr. Silverstein in regard to some witnesses, and in particular, this witness, Monica Sotelo. The state was not given, obviously, Mr. Silverstein's notes. The defense argued at the time that it was work product and we were not entitled to it. So when they asked the question of Monica Sotelo in regard to this conversation that Mr. Silverstein had with Monica Sotelo, not in the first trial, and they asked in the second trial, in regard to this conversation, they knew what the answer was gonna be. And that's what the district court was concentrating on. You had information that you knew she might answer in one particular way. The state never had notice of that. And so because you knew prior to the trial that she might answer in this way, you should have put Mr. Silverstein down as a witness. The defense then tried to characterize the information as rebuttal, because in rebuttal, they would not have to give notice. And that's the distinction that Judge Herndon was making. That's why he cited Gray. He's stated on the record, similarly we have held, or this court has held, that fairness during trial is not one-sided and applies to both the defendant and the state. And his point to the defense was, or the appellant was, you knew that this information might come up. You knew that the answer might be a particular way. So because you had prior notice, that the answer that the witness might answer in a particular way, you should have given the state notice that Mr. Silverstein could have been a witness. The state's argument was, if we had noticed that Mr. Silverstein was going to be a witness in the case, we could have talked to Mr. Silverstein. Whether he would have talked, Mr. Silverstein would have talked to us or not would have been another issue. But that was the issue before the district court. And the district court said that we've been in this trial for 8 days. We are about to close evidence. And now you're asking to bring this witness in without any notice to the state. And Mr. Figler at that point admits he wasn't really contemplating calling Mr. Silverstein. He wasn't sure if he was going to do it. He was going to wait to see how the witness, Monica Sotelo, answered. But he had prior notice that she might answer in a different way. That was the issue in front of the district court. So the state would submit to you that he did not abuse his discretion. Because when he looked at the case at the whole, he realized they had some information. They could have put his name on a witness list, but they chose not to. And then they chose to characterize it as rebuttal witness, as a rebuttal witness, because you don't have to give notice under rebuttal witness, essentially not being fair to both sides, instead essentially skirting the notice that is required under 174.234. That was the issue in front of the district court at that time. Because if the state had had information that we didn't turn over to the defense, and then we tried to characterize it as not impeachment evidence, but rebuttal evidence, we wouldn't have been able to bring it in either. And in fact, to some extent, that's what happened in this case. The state tried to call a rebuttal witness. The judge precluded us from calling that rebuttal witness because he said, state, you had an opportunity in your case in chief to bring out this information. You made a strategic decision not to bring out that information. So you cannot now characterize this as rebuttal witness and then bring the person in. In regard to the use of the transcript in regard to Monica Sotelo.
Before you go there, appellants make a legal argument that the statute should be held unconstitutional. I understand your context argument, and quite frankly, that's not unusual, at least in my experience. The context of these rebuttal witnesses usually come up exactly that way. But what about the legal argument that is proffered by the appellant that the statute should be held unconstitutional?
I don't think that, or it's the state's opinion that the statute should not be held unconstitutional. The issue I think that this court looks at is notice and fairness to both sides. In the Gray case, it was an expert rebuttal witness that the state had noticed that this person was sitting in the room, the doctor was sitting in the room at the same time that the defense expert was sitting in the room. And the state then tried to call the rebuttal witness. I think at the end of the day, when we're trying cases, it's about fairness. And I don't think that it should be unconstitutional because part of the argument is, in the middle of trial, when things happen, you need to call witnesses. I think in this case, the difference is they knew that they might be calling Mr. Silverstein. That's the difference. They knew that he might be a potential witness, and they chose not to put him on the witness list.
So the essence of your argument is that the state is entitled to a fair trial just as the defendant is.
Correct.
Okay.
Do you want me to move on to the use of
the transcript? Do my colleagues have any other questions about that legal point? All right, why don't you proceed with the other issue then?
In regard to the use of the transcript, the district court did not abuse its discretion. I think the characterization of Monica Sotelo's...
Could you clarify exactly how the refreshed recollection occurred? We're going to go back and reread the transcript, but is my description correct that the transcript was shown and the words used from the prior trial were made known to the jury?
I would say that, and it may be a subtle difference, that we were not refreshing Monica Sotelo's recollection. We were actually impeaching Monica Sotelo.
Okay.
Monica Sotelo's testimony is in volume 2 and 3. It starts on page 491. Essentially, what happens is Monica Sotelo testifies at the trial in 2008, and she testifies that she was at the party, that when she was 15 years old, she was pregnant at the time, that somebody bumped into her as they were on their way to the bathroom. The victim then says, hey, don't bump into her, she's pregnant. She then talks about that there's an argument that happens, that she sees that Eddie has a gun. She then sees Eddie go out the back door. She then goes out the back door, and she hears some mumbling. She then testifies that she sees Eddie go around the house. She then goes back into the house, meets up with the rest of her party, and then goes out the front door. That's essentially what her testimony is. She leaves out what the mumbling was. She leaves out statements that she had made to police in 1991, as well as in the trial in 2004. So what counsel did at the time was we then impeached her, and the impeachment starts on page 514 on volume 3 is where we impeached her. We said, isn't it true? And we used the transcript because she was in custody at the time, so it was a little bit difficult to sort of ask her and keep walking back and forth. So we left the transcript in front of her so that she was able to turn the pages on her own. We asked her if she remembers seeing a gun pointed in the room. So it wasn't actually refreshing her recollection. We were at this point impeaching Monica Sotelo about the things that she had seen and testified to in 1991, that she had told officers in 1991, as well as in 2004. Then on cross-examination, the first question was, the things you said to the police in 1991 were wrong, correct? And she says, yes. She then said that she never saw a gun inside the house, that she couldn't hear the mumbling, she didn't see the shooting guns, or she didn't see the person shooting the gun, and she didn't see any gunfire. So now on cross-examination, she's pretty much disavowed what she said in direct, as well as her statement in 1991 and 2004. It's then on redirect, which is in volume 3, page 586, where trial counsel then goes back through, this is what you said in 1991. This is what you said at the trial in 2004. So it's actually not necessarily refreshing her recollection. We're at this point actually impeaching what she's saying, because she's pretty much saying, she's talking about what happened, but she's leaving out specific facts. She's leaving out the facts about the gun. She's leaving out the facts about smoke that fool. She's leaving out the facts that she saw somebody as they were driving away on the side of the road and then walk into the middle of it. She's leaving out all of those facts. Obviously, the state's contention she left it out because we had prosecuted her subsequent to this 1991 incident, and she was being less than forthright and truthful.
Is there any other appellate issue you wanted to address today?
The sufficiency of the evidence. I think that one of the things that was brought up is that this case is largely circumstantial. And I think if you look at trial testimony, Manuel Valenzuela, he testified in volume 4, page 847 to 914. He talks about going to the party. He talks about how he goes into the party and he gets into an argument with somebody while that person is on the way to the bathroom. He then describes how he sees that person outside on the side of the road and how the person is then in front of the car shooting at them. He was in the car with the victim at the time that the shots were fired. If you look at Emma Garcia's testimony, that's volume 2, page 398 to 425. She testifies about the same thing. She's in the party. It is dark. They're standing against a wall. The appellant comes in. There's some type of argument between her boyfriend and the appellant. At one point, he pulls out a gun and points it to the victim's head. She then lifts the gun up sort of in the air this way. So we have a testimony about direct evidence, because she saw that, a gun inside the house, and the appellant is holding the gun. Her testimony is then they are in the car, they are leaving the party. As they're leaving the party, she's sitting in the front passenger seat. She sees the appellant off to the left-hand side, the driver's side. He's first on the street, the same side that the house is on, and then he's in front of the car. Now, her testimony was she saw sparks flying out of his hand, or sparks coming out of his hand. There's no other lights except for the headlights from the car, and she says she sort of sits there for the first couple of shots, and then something sort of zings through her head, and then she realizes gunshots, and she puts her head down. That's direct evidence, and she identified the appellant as the person firing the shots. You then have the testimony of Veronica. Veronica was also at the party. She saw that there was an argument between the appellant and the victim. She then sees the gun. Her mother put the gun up in the air. She then leaves the party. She's in a different car. She turns right as everybody else turns left in the car. She looks in the rearview mirror. She hears a shot, and at that time, she starts making a U-turn. She sees the appellant on the left side of the road, same side of the house, same thing that the other witnesses have testified to, and then she sees him shooting in front of the car. I think to characterize this case as largely circumstantial is unfair if you look at the testimony of each of these witnesses. There's three people that testify, which is direct evidence, that the appellant is the one firing the shot. This court asked a question of Mr. Figler in regard to circumstantial evidence, and essentially his answer was that circumstantial evidence in a case like this would not be enough to convict. And yet the testimony is there from all of the different witnesses, direct testimony, that the appellant is the person that is firing the gun. The appellant is the person that continued to fire the gun as the car drove. I wasn't sure if you were going to ask me a question.
No, I was going to check a note that I had made preparing for the hearing.
You're better off not wanting us to ask you a question.
I just don't want to interrupt.
You go right ahead and finish your thought.
So I think if you look at the testimony from the witnesses, there is direct evidence that a crime was committed and this appellant committed the crime. And with that, unless there are questions, I'll submit it.
Are there any further questions? Apparently not. Ms. Piper, thank you.
Thank you.
I had extended the offer of additional time to appellant. Did you need any additional time to argue any other point? All right. Okay. Mr. Bayless?
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Hornstein. Just in quick response to the abuse of discretion argument presented by the government, I would point out, I think she misspoke. She was referring to Stiletto when she, in fact, meant Veronica Garcia. But albeit, I think the district court's abuse of discretion is twofold. First of all, he ignored the dictates of the Sampson case that states when addressing discovery violations, the district courts must be cognizant that defendants have a constitutional right to discredit their accuser, and there is a strong presumption to allow testimony to even late disclosed witnesses, and evidence should be admitted when it goes to the heart of the case. When you read the Sampson decision in conjunction with NRS 174-234, subsection 3A, where it mandates, it uses the word shall, that before a district court can exclude the, prohibit the testimony of a witness, it has to make the determination that the party acted in bad faith. This was absolutely not a case where the defense acted in bad faith. A mistaken belief as to whether a witness is a rebuttal witness or not, and whether notice needs to be given, is not bad faith. As a matter of fact, the state was on notice from the transcripts of the 2004 trial regarding the interview with Dan Silverstein between and Veronica Garcia. During the course of the trial, because we kept waiting for them to call Veronica Garcia, and they chose to call her at the very end of their case, we advised them that depending on what she said, there's a possibility that we may have to call Dan Silverstein in rebuttal. And Mr. Pesci acknowledged that on the record. When we got in front of the court,
go ahead and finish your comment.
When we got in front of the court, the court did not make any finding of bad faith. Certainly, these last 3 points, the state did not request the continuance. The state did not tell how this additional investigation, by not being provided, it would prejudice the state. And the state did not allege unfair surprise regarding the Silverstein testimony. We could have cured this in a half hour. Mr. Silverstein was in the waiting room. The state could have gone in there and talked to him. We could have had a short continuance outside the presence of the jury. The state could have talked to him, find out what he was going to testify to. As far as the memo under subsection 7 of 174-234, we don't have to give over privileged documents such as work product. We were willing to give it to the court, make an in-camera review, make a determination if we had to turn it over, if we were required to, we were going to miss, and we wouldn't be here today if the court had granted a short half-hour continuance and they had interviewed Mr. Silverstein and we presented them and I asked him And the questions I were asking were right out of the memo that I submitted as the offer of proof. Thank you.
Mr. Bayless, before you sit down, because we got back to this little subtle issue of substantial evidence and the testimony of this particular witness. But before Ms. Piper sat down, she talked about the direct evidence produced by the other witnesses. Why shouldn't we just look at this as harmless in light of that other testimony?
Because it's not harmless. First of all, the whole case was about identification. They had four witnesses at the initial trial which identified our client as the shooter. One of the witnesses, three of them were somewhat related, and one of the witnesses was the 15-year-old Maria Stiletto. She recants at the second trial. Our whole case was to discredit their eyewitness identification. And I want to point out something. I think this is an important thing. If, unfortunately, this court is left with a cold record, you didn't get to see the witnesses. Emma Garcia was had the histrionics when she was on the stand. I mean, she was hyperventilating. She was, Stiletto recants. Manuel doesn't come across because he used an interpreter. So finally, they're left with their last witness. Obviously, they felt it was their strong witness, Emma Garcia. Veronica Garcia. During cross-examination, she started presenting facts that were never presented, either in the police reports, the earlier trial, the preliminary hearing. I mean, when I was establishing this was a rural gravel road with no headlights, and then for the first time she says, well, my high beams were on, and that's why I can see them. And then when the juror asked her, well, based on your story, didn't you pass Mr. Pena when you were trying to catch up your mother? And for the first time we have this mystery car that comes out of nowhere that was not in any of the earlier police reports or testimony. The discredition of Veronica Garcia was at the heart of our case, and we needed that statement where she told Dan Silverstein, well, I really didn't see the shooter, but who else could it be? He shot at him inside the house. Those are the type of arguments you make to a jury when you read them the credibility instruction. You point out to the jury how they've contradicted, how they didn't have the opportunity to observe, how they've testified differently. These are the substance of discrediting your accuser, and we were deprived of that, and it was not harmless.
Mr. Bayless, do you or Mr. Figler or perhaps Ms. Piper have the record cite for your offer of proof?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
In regard to Monica Sotelo, the direct, the cross, or the redirect?
No, I've got the Sotelo cites, the offer of proof with regard to what Silverstein was going to say.
Apologize to the court. It's contained in volume 6.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. If you don't have it handy, we've got the record here.
I think it's somewhere near 1467 through 1478, somewhere in that range.
Volume 7, 461-62.
Would you repeat that, please?
Cited in the defense reply brief as volume 7, pages 1461-62.
Okay.
Whereas
thank
Mr.
you.
Bayless recites the offer of proof to the court with regard to what Mr. Silverstein was expected to testify.
Okay,
thank you.
All right, anything further?
No, thank you.
All right, anything from my colleagues? All right. Counsel, we appreciate your excellent arguments this morning and your briefs in this matter. And the matter will stand submitted. We wish you a happy holiday.